Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Humans love to make cults and belief sets around things. It's a really interesting and unfortunate trait of humans. But similarly, these New Agers will do that with mountains and pyramids. And if we look across time, we see this pyramid worship everywhere, coming from the old days. And I think it's because the Nephilim hid inside the mountains. I think that's your real inner earth kingdom. And of course, like, there's caves and stuff is hollow and all that kind of stuff. But when you look at stories like Mount Shasta, when you look at stories like Agartha, all that kind of stuff, it makes the most sense. I think that the inner earth is just literally a Nephilim kingdom, and that when we have these stories from high profile individuals and scientists and doctors and Navy admirals and, you know, all of these explorers and all of these people who, you know, like, go hunting for these things, and they have stories and reasons for why they believe in them, it's because they probably are seeing something that has existed throughout time. Hey everybody, welcome back to the 21CD podcast. As always, I am your ghost, John. If this is your first time here, find somewhere to sit, and we hope you stay a long time, okay? And if you guys are into conspiracy theories and cryptids and dystopian discussions and all that kind of stuff, go ahead and shoot me a follow so you can be informed when I drop new stuff. All of your likes, your shares, your hype points, and your 5-star ratings are greatly appreciated. That's the only way this show grows. I don't have any sponsors or anything like that. So thank you. Okay? If you guys want a chance to be on the show, 21cdstudios.com. I've also got a reading list and some merchy poo up there that you can check out if you're into that sort of thing. All right. Let's get into this. What if there is an offshoot country or place where a select few of the Nephilim have continued to rule while enslaving a race of humans who have been abducted and essentially tasked to be their workforce and supply? If the Nephilim really did maintain some kind of sacred sciences as given to Adam by God and are somehow able to continually utilize those sciences without major corruption, it would explain a number of things. It would explain, for instance, missing 411, and massive amounts of missing people could easily be explained for the first time ever. It would make sense that they are being taken to the inner earth to be used as a slave race for the inner race. Okay, the inner race would also answer the questions relating to where and how Nephilim lived and survived the flood and then subsequently continued to live afterwards. The inner race also provides a place for celebrities and politicians and world leaders who serve the best to have a magical place to run off to. A real-life Disneyland, if you will. That's why they're so eager to run off and abandon their own kind and serve the best, as I say. Just like in the ancient days, they believe they have met God and God has told them that they are special, so they obey God, who convinces them that they are somehow better than certain people on Earth, so it's okay to harm and eat and traffic and bomb those people. They do this happily with the promise of long life and the chance to live in actual, real-life Disneyland. Super fun. The only problem is that that's not God. Who they're talking to ain't God. That's something else. So this thing that tells them that they're better, that they're special, that they're elite, that they are somehow closer to God than the rest of these jokers down here that they farm, that's not God telling them that. To them, though, it's just too late. They've accepted this God, and they are under this spell, or perhaps it has overtaken them, and they are to a degree trapped. Either way, it's hard for them to stop thinking about real-life Disneyland, because it's so much better than theme park Disneyland, and especially just regular world life, because real-life Disneyland is the whole, your whole life, as if you were in some magical, fantastic realm. You know, theme park Disneyland only lasts a few days. So the sacrifice that these predatory individuals make is considered worth it. Even if this is a false or fallen god, technically, they look around and they don't see anything else more powerful that can provide them with more than this entity. And so this entity becomes their god. Also, this entity could fucking kill them whenever they wanted to for not obeying them. And so there's that extra little grip on their soul and on their life. Speaking of, the grip that this kind of breakaway society would have over the entire world is absolutely unmeasurable, by the way. To ignore this society, which we are now calling the inner race, would be to essentially ignore the most powerful, witnessable creatures on the face of the planet, and maybe in the known universe. So imagine, when we talk about this breakaway society, we're talking about this society that is, it's a Nephilim society with humans involved, because Nephilim can't really do anything by themselves. This is something that seems to be repeating throughout time. The Nephilim themselves, besides waging war and generally engaging in chaos, they don't seem to actually be able to do anything themselves. They don't seem to be able to write books. They don't seem to be able to create art. They don't seem to be able to create their own religions around them. They don't seem to be able to do anything. They need a task force to do that, which is why they're always, you know, trying to take these human women. This is why they're always enslaving humankind, etc., etc. And so, if you were a regular human and you came upon one of these societies, these breakaway examples of a Nephilim society, what you would essentially see is probably something that has existed for thousands of years with a relatively perfect, it's not perfect, but a relatively unmanipulated set of sciences that may have been stolen from Adam when Adam and Eve were forced out of the garden, okay? And the fallen angels eventually began to take over Earth and establish their domain and sort of infringe upon humanity, okay? So, assuming that the flood is coming and all this kind of stuff, we're going to get into the flood a little bit, but the flood is coming, this breakaway society essentially separates to prepare for the flood. They begin to mine out mountains and stuff like that. They have a rough idea of how they're going to try to survive this thing. So they go into various mountains all over the globe, all over the world, whatever you want to say, all over the plane, however you want to say it. They go over the whole realm and they start building these underground facilities, these cities in mountains and stuff like that. Okay. Nowadays, and they exist and they survived the flood and they existed all the way until now within the earth. Okay. If you were an outer race being like us, and you were brought into the circle of this inner race, let's say you're a global leader, and you're brought into the circle of this inner race, and they're like, listen, you are the president of Russia, we need something done over in your corner of the map. This is what you're going to do. And if you do it, if we're happy, You can have all of this. And it's something that looks like Agartha. It's something that looks like Telos. It's something that looks like, you know, Shambhala. It's something that looks like one of these realms that is highly, highly advanced, highly, highly majestic, and populated by powerful individuals that seem to think, or at least entities, that seem to think that they have some sort of answer for the world, for correcting it, for putting it back where it's supposed to be since humanity has fallen. And now imagine that you're like, no. You would be ignoring essentially the most powerful, witnessable creatures on the face of the planet and maybe the entire universe. The balls that would take. Because they would be able to show you all the powers of the ancient gods, you know, the powers of Zeus, the powers of Thor, the powers of demigods like Hercules, the power of, Nike, the power of Apollo, like all of these things, they would be able to sort of be like, look, man, that's us. Those stories that you've been hearing, that's us, man. And we're welcoming you into our fold if you do the right things. Right? And that would be incredibly hard to say no to. Especially when they start offering you a place in their society where many of your friends or people you know maybe, other world leaders, you know, Hollywood stars, other billionaires, many of which who have helped you get to where you are today. The civilization would have no deadbeats in it. So it would appear to be this sort of upper class elite utopia with promises of a sort of long life and perhaps even an escape from death itself, perhaps immortality, but especially an escape from the troubles of real life on the surface. Essentially, it's a counterfeit heaven. And not only would you not want to say no because they might be false gods, you would be afraid to say so because surely these are the actual fucking gods. And you would be afraid that they would come for you if you say no and just smite you. There will be no way to stop them from killing you if you say no, because they have the secret sciences and alchemy and hybrids and angels and technology, and they are the old gods and you know, all of this power they have, and I'm just a regular guy. I'm just Vlad, man. A realm like this that is constantly asserting pressure on the people that we elect, it also explains psychopathy. It explains the steady supply of inner race politicians that impact politics of the outer race world. It also explains hard boundaries over specific locations like Antarctica. It explains why all of these really super rich, wealthy people behave like this isn't the only planet that they have at their disposal. This isn't the only location they have at their, you know, at their fingertips. They can whisk away whenever they want. They can disappear. There's something coming after. The politicians and many of the big superstars of the world generally have that vibe to them. Like, they don't actually believe that this is their final realm that they're going to inhabit. A lot of them seem to have this secret place that they run off to, or that they're going to run off to. And for many people, it's both. Like, Elon Musk has his whole underground tunnel system and all this kind of stuff. Like, who knows what these people are really doing? But needless to say, humans have the ability to create entire underground cities. Massive. It would blow your mind how massive they are. And they do it all of the time. It's not new, and it's not even something that is like conspiratorial. Like, if you go into any of these massive bunkers that have been prepared for the end of the world, where thousands of people are allegedly going to be able to seek shelter. You know, places like those that exist in Colorado under the Denver International Airport and Mount Cheyenne and all this kind of stuff. Like this, you know, the stuff that we talk about in the national parks, where there's a great many mountains in the national parks that appear to be actually hollow. You could even add Mount Shasta to the list. We're going to talk about Mount Shasta today.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
When you think about all of these things, and throughout time, you see cities that have been destroyed through cataclysms on the surface. Let's just talk about the, you know, let's just say Sodom and Gomorrah. Let's just say Atlantis. Let's just say Alexandria. Let's just say, you know, Jerusalem. Let's just say there's all of these cities and many of these great, great examples of civilization that have been completely destroyed by cataclysms on the surface. Look at Iceland. Iceland was absolutely positively nuked, okay? So it's just, you have all of this, and throughout time, this has been pushing people deeper and deeper into the earth. We have ancient examples of underground locations that could house thousands of people. That technology, if it hasn't gotten better, at least when it comes to digging underground, it's remained consistent enough that we still do it on a widespread basis. It's just that people like you and me don't spend a lot of time underground. We don't have a reason to be there. But there are people in the world, and there are entities in the world that do have reasons to be there. And so being underground would be a regular thing. Now, on a deeper level, this concept of a breakaway Nephilim society that lives inside the earth, it provides an explanation for other ideas revolving around timeline resets due to archaeological confusion, locations of technological and societal progress that vastly outpace and outdo other locations on the same planet. And even, like we said before, things like Atlantis, missing continents on maps, how maps change throughout time, how survival through apocalypse after apocalypse has continued, and the same general mythology across all cultures on the planet sort of existing. It also clearly confirms this concept of this breakaway society inside the earth. It clearly confirms that history repeats itself. It does so each time that the inner race touches the outer race. And you see this. You see explosions of rapid advances in technology or civilizations. And these are signs to me that the inner race is sort of tampering with the outer race. It easily validates and explains the inner earth theory as well, which is one that a lot of conspiracy theorists have been talking about for a very long time. And it raises more questions, you could say, about Middle Earth and what Tolkien may have been privy to. A lot of people are of the mind that Tolkien, who wrote Lord of the Rings, was sort of writing a true story or a story based on truth instead of just some random fantasy, because he seemed to have a lot of knowledge about the structure of the universe and the world and the hierarchy of spiritual beings and all of that kind of stuff, okay? And I'm not forcing this to be real. I am just saying that if you believe that the aliens, if you believe that the ancient ancestors, the ancient people, the Nephilim, the fallen angels that are said to be chained beneath the ground, all of this kind of stuff, and the fallen ones that are not, where are they? Because if they've been sort of cast out of heaven or fallen from heaven, they're probably not in, I don't know, Obviously, I'm just speculating here, but they're probably not still in heaven. They're probably not allowed to come and go as they please, which means they must be seeking residence somewhere, right? Lying dormant somewhere. There must be these pockets of supreme power in those locations where they are, I would assume, considering that I believe in these sort of things. You kind of have to believe in these sort of things to even see what I'm saying as anything more than just a absolutely psychotic sort of rant. But I believe that aliens and these fallen ones and these Nephilim are kind of the one and the same. And so if it's easier for me to believe in the inner earth, where these things, everybody has these stories all across the world of how their ancestors came out of the earth and all of that kind of stuff. You've got the star people for sure, but you've also got the people coming out of the earth for some reason. They sought shelter within the earth, a lot of them during the flood, and then they came out, okay? There's stories across almost every single civilization, including almost every single Native American tribe, about this concept of beings coming out of the earth. And they kind of outnumber the beings coming from outer space stories, which makes me lean more heavily on the idea that I think there are still Nephilim inside the earth. And a lot of these stories where these explorers encounter locations of extreme magnificence and extreme beauty and extreme power and wonder, these places, it's very possible, are inner earth Nephilim kingdoms. I don't think they're places that we want to be. Because when I hear about them, when I read about them, so often it feels like there's like a, almost like an anti-God kind of vibe to these inner earth cities. Does anybody else feel that way? It just feels like there's something about them that is off-putting. We mentioned Mount Shasta a little bit. Places like Mount Shasta are kind of what I'm talking about because they're said to be home to this wonderful city of Telos, of Lemuria, or, you know, something like the entrance to Shangri-La that is said to be in Nepal, or another example is Admiral Richard E. Byrd's Agartha beyond the North Pole. These become actual entrances to these inner earth kingdoms, these inner earth Nephilim kingdoms, or at least portals of some side of some sort to them. You could even say that things like the Bermuda Triangle or the Lake Michigan Triangle, there's a lot of triangles, and I think that the reason everything is triangular with these Nephilims and with these secret societies, and, you know, like we think about the pyramids, we think about the tops of the obelisks, which, you know, all of these things. We think about the mountains that are hollowed out. We think about stuff like the Bermuda Triangle, the Michigan Triangle. A lot of we think about the all-seeing eye on the dollar and how it's in the top of the pyramid, and it's all this kind of stuff. I think it's because it is a symbol of mountain worship. I think that these entities, these people, all this triangle and pyramid obsession, I think is them paying homage, essentially, to the mountains that have saved them time and time again from destruction. And this isn't because God is unable to destroy them. I think that this is all part of his plan. It's not necessarily always his plan to wipe everything out, and then all of the sudden, these crafty Nephilim outsmarted God. I don't think it's like that any more than it's like you or me outsmarting God, okay? I think some things just happen, and God doesn't necessarily stop everything that's happening. He doesn't intervene in every little situation, and he might see these Nephilim kingdoms as small peanuts compared to what's really going on that he's going to have to deal with eventually. So when we see all these triangles and these pyramids, I often immediately attribute them to Nephilim activity and Nephilim worship because I think that they represent mountains. Okay? They could be portals, and that explains so many missing aircraft and ships and individuals. These Bermuda Triangles and these Michigan Triangle type situations. All of these locations where people encounter the inner earth, or, you know, these triangles. They can be thought of as collection points. You know, things are sort of disappearing because they're getting sucked in. They're being hallucinated to the point where they are entering of their own volition. You know, we have China right now has these very highly advanced direct energy weapons, which I assume means that many of the highly developed military powers of the world probably do. That is said to actually distort time by the people who are impacted. The people who are impacted by this weapon, some of these direct energy weapons, they go through intense hallucinations and time loss because these weapons that if you've ever heard of what was it called, like the Havana sickness or the Havana illness or something, that's kind of the same concept where you lose track of reality when you're impacted by these weapons. And so if these weapons, you know, like even in Venezuela, like some of the stories that were coming out of Venezuela, we obviously implemented direct energy weapons on them too, and it caused them to basically explode from the inside out, to melt from the inside out, and also just become completely delusional and useless to defending their president. Like, it's crazy. So if we can do that as humans, it's no surprise to me that when you come across one of these locations out in the wild where you might enter into an inner earth kingdom or through a triangle or something like that, you're being impacted by angelic technology or Nephilim technology, and it's a trap, essentially, okay? I think that there's something like this that could be being used in some of these locations, and that is sort of why these locations are as mysterious and conspiratorial as they are. They're like giant mouse traps, essentially. And the Nephilim, the ones who live in the inner earth realm, they need things from the surface, okay? Because life is not meant to be sustained beneath the ground, first of all. That's somewhat against nature. It's kind of against animal kind to spend your whole life below ground. Even the animals that live below ground, they hibernate there. They don't stay there forever. They come to the surface for food. They come to the surface for water. They come to the surface for, the sun. All of these types of things. They're nocturnal, so they come out at night. Whatever the case is, it's kind of against nature for something, especially something humanoid, to be under the ground all the time. So, safe to say, the things that choose to be there are there because they are heinous monsters, or they have a reason to hide from what's on the surface. And Nephilim can take advantage of both of those explanations for why something would be underground. Okay? I also think that they are some of the smarter beings on the planet. And not only that, but they are surrounded by many talented, artistic, and powerful minds from the outer race. And that's how a lot of this satanic witchcraft and these evil laws and rules and regulations and all this kind of stuff, all of that influence is coming from them, okay? They're these high-class individuals, these high-class artists and these witches of the world, these politicians, these horrible Epstein types, all of these people are taking their lessons directly from evil and putting them upon the rest of us, okay? And these Nephilim essentially keep all these people prisoner with promises of a better future, and they have to continually abduct more of these people and keep these people indoctrinated, because like we said before, these people from the surface, these leaders, these artists, these politicians, these musicians, these types, they are needed to keep the Nephilim sustained. That is the whole story of the Nephilim. Essentially, why they had to be wiped out to such a great degree was because they were consuming and destroying mankind. But obviously, evil is still on the face of the earth, and we have not been redeemed. And so there is still a spiritual war going on. There is still a sequence of battles that are raging, which would imply that the Nephilim or their spirits are still here, and therefore they still need humankind to do what they need them to do so that they are still in power, so that they are still relevant, so that they can still survive. Even if they are separated from society, all of society still serves them secretly, okay? It essentially becomes exactly like the days of Noah in there. And you've got all of these individuals from the surface who, even though they are serving and they are enslaved by this master race, this inner race, okay, they also need things. They're going to request things that they have become reliant on or that they deem essential for their well-being, like things like art, things like beauty, things like class, nice food. They're going to need people to serve them too. They're going to need their own slaves, even though they are humans as well. They're going to need doctors and chefs. They're going to need to engage in sexual depravity. All of these things they're going to need as well. And it essentially, yeah, it becomes exactly like the days of Noah in there. Okay? Pretty evil, fucked up slave system that surprisingly looks a lot like what they do to us on the surface, because what they do to us on the surface of the earth is exactly like what they are being subjected to by the inner earth race. This is all just an idea, okay? But it makes more sense to me than aliens coming from outer space, because we do have to explain what is happening and where they would come from if not outer space. I believe one explanation for this is inside the earth.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
And they serve these Nephilim agendas, you know, from real life Disneyland. And so they always have this thing to rely on. They can commit these evils and these atrocities because their fate in their mind is already sealed. And it looks great. And as long as they just keep doing what they're doing for the Neff gang, then they're going to get real-life Disneyland for the rest of their lives. And some of them probably know that these are the actual fallen gods and angels that have existed all through time. Some of them probably don't care. Some of them are NPCs. They're so dumb they don't even know what they're doing when they serve these beings. But all of this, when you think about it, starts to explain a lot of other things too, like Tartaria and how the timeline appears to be whack and janky. It's because of these inner earth kingdoms that come to the surface. They only exist in our realm for a very small amount of time and then they disappear again. Okay? It would explain things like Alexander the Great and his insane abilities on Earth and his subsequent disappearance. We have no idea where this guy is. We don't know where he died. We don't know where his body is. We don't know anything. It would also explain things like the vanishing of the Library of Alexandria and so many of these other examples of great, quote-unquote, human achievement that have been recorded in history but are just gone. One of the most interesting problems in the study of world civilization, in my opinion, is the origin of the first races of man in America. Okay? It's been commonly believed as a popular idea that the cradle of civilization was in Mesopotamia. But there is also a very general belief that the first races of man could be traced to some Oriental country. I don't necessarily believe that myself, but these are some options that people choose to believe in. A while back, scientists started proposing that the Ohio River Valley might have been the location of the original Garden of Eden, even. Like, we've heard of that concept before and how some of the tribes of Israel are Native Americans and, like, stuff like that. So, when considering whether all human races share a common origin, which, if you believe in Adam and Eve, you probably believe that we do share a common origin, but there is the question of, you know, was day six man different from Adam and Eve just because Adam and Eve were the first people essentially mentioned by name does not mean that there weren't more among them by the time they became essentially administrators over the Garden of Eden. it doesn't seem like the Bible specifically says that all human beings came from Adam and Eve, because there's biblical questions that can be raised, especially around, you know, okay, why did the Bible say that there was no woman suitable for Adam? Does that mean there was no other woman, or does that mean that Adam just needed a special woman, you know? And then you have Cain going off to the land of Nod to get a wife and like stuff like this. Like there just seems to be these indications that maybe there were people on the planet besides Adam and Eve. And that doesn't contradict the Bible in any way. But basically, if you consider that all human races share a common origin, then it's kind of important to remember that in order for humanity to have begun in one location and spread across the globe, there would have been ways and means for those migrations. And the evidence seems to suggest that many vast areas are now covered by oceans, but they were once continents, or at a minimum, very large islands that facilitated movement between them. The oceanic journeys were much shorter and less hazardous. And you can think about this as a byproduct of the flood, perhaps. You can think about this as the same concept as the Tower of Babel, where they had to be sort of scattered and the distances between them had to grow because they were so powerful that if they thought with one mind, there was nothing they could not do. And so God invented these languages, essentially, and scattered their tongues and their understandings, right? There's also additional evidence that indicates that humans arrived in America via different routes at different times. It wasn't just Columbus. It wasn't just the Vikings. Like, you have all these different people, including, like, the Phoenicians, even, who seem to say and seem to indicate that they arrived on some distant land that seemed magical and mysterious, okay? And a lot of people believe that that is North and South America. But there's also the concept that humans may have originated independently in separate regions without awareness of other races, and they gradually built their unique civilizations. They had sort of a baseline of understanding to begin with. And if humanity did indeed have a single origin and spread after achieving a high degree of, civilization, then those who settled distant lands, those who scattered, would have brought advanced culture and practices with them. And there's a lot of evidence of early migrations, especially along South America's Pacific coast, which is really relevant to studying the disappearance of the continent known as Lemuria. So the global flood that has been described in countless traditions was probably not something simultaneous, but something that occurred gradually, causing continents to vanish over time. I think it can be considered something that was kind of a bit of a gradual process. You know, we like to think of the flood as something that happened instantaneous, and it took a matter of hours before the whole earth was flooded and all that kind of stuff. But how long was Noah in the ark? Noah was in the ark for 370 to 371 days, allegedly. Okay? And key details of this timeline include 40 days and nights for that, and that's what it took for the rain and the flood water to rise. And then 150 days, the water prevailed on the earth. And the ark grounded on the mountains of Ararat after 150 days. But there was this period of waiting. Several months passed before the ground was dry enough for them to leave the ark. Okay, so we have about this 370-day period, allegedly, that it appeared the grounds around the ark were submerged or becoming submerged. That's a long time for water to spread across the planet. Okay, so that would make, that leads me to this idea that perhaps the flood was not simultaneous. It was a gradual process that caused continents to vanish over the course of a year. And nearly every tribe around the world has legends of a great flood. And so if some of these tribes, some of these people are experiencing this flooding, you know, a month before the other part of the world, that gives a lot of cultures a lot of time to develop stories. There were these early explorers who arrived in America, and they were amazed to discover that a lot of these isolated tribes with no apparent connection to Asian traditions had many of the same flood stories that were found in Genesis and also told throughout Asia. So how did this narrative reach American Indians and hundreds of other tribes without them having already existed and gone through this by themselves? Historically, people believed that humans first appeared in America only shortly before Columbus or other explorers. And when I say America, I'm generally talking about North, Central, and South. Like, this is all America. This is the mysterious land of America. Okay, if you can get to one, you can get to any of the others. And so this is America. We have North, Central, and South. And South America is obviously incredibly important for all of this. But when it comes to North America, yeah, they generally believed that these people were not very advanced, so they must not have been here very long. But we know by studying historical timelines that these North American tribes appeared to have inhabited America for, according to their timelines, tens of thousands of years. And we appear to have archaeological evidence of this as well. Tens of thousands of years. So today, it's kind of indisputable that humans lived in North America thousands of years ago, and that the ancient races here were equal or possibly even superior to those in the Old World at the same time. You have the people like the Anasazi and the Cahokia, who we can point to as examples for this. A lot of these ancient cities in these North American empires were bigger than cities like London at the time and stuff like that. Some of this sort of indisputable evidence can be seen through the exhibits that we see when we look at the gravel deposits of Frederick, Oklahoma. There's some stuff in New Mexico where we've seen artifacts that were buried alongside animals known to have existed only in ancient times. So that sort of indicates that, like, these animals I'm talking about, like mastodons and camels and horses and elephants and ground sloths and all these other things, that we have literally found flint arrowheads and spearheads found next to or beneath the fossils, along with other human-made objects. Some even discovered within the bodies themselves of these animals. Like, we've confirmed that these animals were hunted because we have arrowheads that are literally embedded in their bones. So we know that there was hunting going on in North America for many, many years, at least back to this time. It's generally understood and recognized and acknowledged that continents and islands haven't just completely submerged over the centuries. And in many cases, they've only partially sunk, with large islands sort of tilting or dipping to one side. And when one end of an island dips, the other rises higher above the water. This is similar to what happens when a large piece of wood kind of floats on the water and it's pushed down on one side. The other side rises up, right? Especially if geological events like eruptions or earthquakes cause this shift, this is something that you will see out of a landmass. It's very interesting. And then there's these studies of ancient maps and deep sea explorations that reveal many underwater areas that clearly were once above sea level. And then there's these other places where investigations of flora and soil and rocks show that there were regions long covered by water that have only recently, comparatively speaking, emerged onto dry land. And so we're constantly seeing this changing this changing land mass. In other words, there was a lot going on before the flood, because it was most likely much easier to get from point A to point B in these older days, because there was probably less ocean. The western portion of the United States is thought to be a remnant, however, of the submerged continent of Lemuria. And these human beings appeared to have reached a higher state of cultural development and civilization than other races of man in their day. Mount Shasta is California's tallest, and some consider it the oldest volcano in the land. And the natives believe a powerful race of entities reside above the tree line on Mount Shasta. And the Indians of the Pacific Northwest, and those of some other areas also, believed that before the first Indians were created, the world was inhabited by a race of animal people. Coyote, or Coyote, was essentially this demigod, godlike being. And once he was traveling around and he was carrying his bow and arrows with him, and he came to a body of water where an evil spirit lived. And seeing Coyote, the evil spirit rose out of the water and said, "There is no wood." And then the evil began causing the water to rise and overflow the land until Coyote was covered with water. And after a time, the water went down and the land dried off, and Coyote sprang up and he took his bow and arrow and he shot the evil spirit. And then he ran away, but the water followed him. So Coyote ran to higher ground, and the water followed him to higher ground still. So he started up Mount Shasta, and the water followed him up Mount Shasta, and he ran to the top of the mountain, where the water followed him, and it became very deep, but it did not quite reach the top. And on the top of Mount Shasta, Coyote made a fire on the only ground that was left above the water. Grizzly Bear saw the fire and swam to the top of Fire Mountain. Deer saw the fire and swam to it. So did elk, black bear, gray squirrel, jackrabbit, and ground squirrel. Badger, porcupine, and raccoon also saw the fire, and they all swam to it. Fish, wolf, and cougar swam there. All the animal people stayed on top of Mount Shasta until the great flood was over. And when at last the water went down, there was dry land in the midst of lakes and marshes, and that's when the animal people came down from the top of Mount Shasta and made these new homes for themselves, and they scattered everywhere and became the ancestors of all the animal people on the earth. Now, I think this is very interesting because this clearly sounds like a Nephilim story. This sounds like a story of hybrids who sought to overcome and survive the flood, and so they ran to the top of Mount Shasta, which for some reason, according to this story, was one of the places that appeared to not be covered completely by the flood water. This is clearly a flood story, okay? We've got a couple different stories here, and it seems like the story of Coyote or Coyote is probably a Nephilim flood story.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
And it's sort of the foundation for why people believe that Mount Shasta might have an ancient inner earth city inside it. A Nephilim city, in my opinion. And then you have the story of J.C. Brown in 1934, which is an interesting year for Mount Shasta. These 1930s years, very interesting for Mount Shasta. But in 34, there was this eccentric elderly Englishman who sort of popped up in the city of Stockton, California, and he claimed to be a millionaire. He refused to give his real name, and he said that he was just going to go by J.C. Brown. And Brown told the townspeople that he discovered a lost city in Mount Shasta, which obviously to them was just a nearby mountain. And since the early 20th century, this mountain was rumored to be home of the Lemurians, which people now often regard as some made-up enlightened race that's only prominent in the lore of New Age and mystical circles. And I would argue that it is taken home in the New Age circles and these mystical circles, but its origins might be much deeper and more complex than that. And Brown claimed that an ancient Lemurian village was hidden in Mount Shasta, and that he had found a cave in the mountain that led to the place's ruins. From the Stockton record, which featured a transcript of Brown's discovery, in his own words, he said, "Two rooms, about 12 by 20 feet, were filled with copper and gold tablets, about 3 by 4 inches and concave, so that one laid inside the other. The rooms were literally full of these plates, inscribed neatly. Another room contained many weapons. The tempered copper spears were so that one could bend the head of the weapon to the base of the shaft and it would spring back into place. Streets were laid out in the village. In one long room were laid at angles to the wall 27 skeletons, the smallest of which was 6 feet 6 inches and the tallest more than 10 feet. In another room lay, apparently embalmed by some secret process, the bodies of a man and a woman dressed in royal robes, whom I believed were the king and queen of this place. The worship room was beautiful to behold. There on the walls were 3 great crosses, not of the conventional modern type, and a sun designed and worked in copper and gold. The streamers from the sun were worked in gold stringers. There were, I believe, 13 statues made of copper and gold. I believe this race of people forms an important link in ancient American civilization. They were highly skilled craftsmen, as their work shows, because there was a glow to 3 of these statues. I believe they used radium, and I believed it was with the use of radium that they tempered copper." Brown, of course, according to his story, was very eager to excavate this site. And originally he wanted his family to help them, but each of his relatives died one after the other, according to the story. And so he'd come to appeal to the people of Stockton because he was willing to share the treasure that he supposedly found. And even though Brown had no evidence whatsoever to show for this, aside from some pictures that he claimed were in a bank vault in Texas, there were about 80 people who agreed to join this expedition with him. So over a period of 6 weeks, Brown and his followers met twice a day to discuss their plan. And he promised to start this expedition on June 18th in 1934, when all of his followers would meet at the house of John C. Root, a member of Brown's party. Of course, as luck would have it, on that day, he left the house early in the morning, and, of course, didn't return in the afternoon. As a matter of fact, he never returned, period. He disappeared into thin air. And we still don't know where he is. We don't know if he skipped town. We don't know if he was kidnapped by someone and caught up in foul play. If he made the whole thing up and just disappeared. So, of course, naturally, people started saying things like, well, this just proves that the whole thing was made up. There's no such thing as Lemurians, and Brown must have lied about finding the village. But unlike a typical scam artist, and this is what I find so bizarre about the case, Brown never actually took any money from his followers. He spent 6 weeks hyping the expedition up, planning every little detail. Yet he never asked for a penny. And so that kind of begs the question, why would Brown devote so much time to a hoax that earned him nothing? Was it all just for fun? On the other hand, perhaps he met foul play before he could actually con anybody out of their money. Maybe he hadn't reached the receiving of money phase yet. But the Stockton record does note that Brown lived in a federal shelter as an amnesia victim before he arrived in Stockton. So there's also the theory that he was just mentally ill or delusional. This legend had other people contribute to it at the same exact time, which I found really bizarre to find out. Because coincidentally, also in 1934, J.C. Brown was not the only person trying to unveil the secrets of Mount Shasta. Unveiled Mysteries by Godfrey Ray King, which is the pseudonym of Guy Warren Ballard, was another interesting piece of literature to come out in 34, specifically about Shasta. Ballard, who was writing under the pseudonym of Godfrey Ray King, says that while on business near Mount Shasta in 1930, he went hiking and he encountered a radiant young stranger, later revealed as Saint Germain, and had his life permanently redirected, he said. Saint Germain allegedly teaches Ballard projected consciousness, which the book sharply distinguishes from trance or hypnosis or suggestion. It presents this as total conscious mastery rather than some passive occultism, some trick. And through that method, Ballard is shown an ancient Sahara that was once fertile. It was semi-tropical and home to a highly advanced empire at its peak some 70,000 years ago. And in this lost civilization, people supposedly understood themselves as sons of God, and they used powers that modern people would call miraculous, and they lived within a luminous, ceremonial style of culture that was symbolized by jeweled halls and self-luminous globes, this sort of invisible music and ritual banquets and light from bizarre places. But the lesson beneath the spectacle is that civilizations rise when they remember divine law, and they collapse when power is misused. So the Sahara sequence essentially ends in cataclysm, with the fertile realm submerged and later transformed into the desert known today, the Sahara, obviously. And a lot of people believe, because of scientific findings too, that the Sahara used to be a rainforest. It used to be green. It used to be lush. And so this is an interesting correlation there. And then from there, of course, the book escalates into the inner world geography. And Ballard is summoned to the Royal Teton, which is a hidden retreat of the Brotherhood, okay? And it's reached through out-of-body travel and these dove-born messages and occult passageways. And the Royal Teton is presented not like a cave, but more of like a spiritual sort of command center. It's got this vaulted chamber with a seven-pointed star, planetary disks and color rays. It has a giant all-seeing eye and forces that are said to be directed into humanity and nature. This is also where the book begins tying Ballard's present identity to former incarnations in Atlantis or Poseidonis. Saint Germain shows him sealed ancient mines in Yellowstone, for instance, and they're filled with yellow diamonds and gold and preserved machinery and imperishable metals and hidden records, and claims that Ballard himself discovered and operated them in a former life 14,000 years earlier. I don't know what to think about that, but the larger claim is very interesting to me, which is that of sacred technology and lost history and buried wealth, all of this divine science and tech that haven't necessarily vanished. It's all been sealed away until the proper cycle and the proper initiate, if you will, return. The humanity that is deemed good enough to wield it by perhaps these Nephilim or fallen overlords. I don't really think it's a battle between like God and angels, like good angels and, you know, the forces of God and righteousness. I don't really think it's a, you know, like them waiting to give us the tech. I think it's more like the Nephilim and the fallen ones who have stolen this from us that are keeping it secret in these inner earth realms. If I was to explain this, okay? And again, going back, these are all realms that were once inhabited by people that, like prior to the flood. And so that's when they went into the earth. That's when they really started digging into the earth and keeping these troves of their technology and what they know, their intelligence, the information they have, the knowledge they have, the tech they have. It all went into the earth pre-flood and sort of just stayed there and continued to develop through this use of slave systems. Of a slave system that takes surface people inside the earth. This really isn't that hard to believe when, you know, like people are so quick to stack missing 411 cases on top of cave systems, you know, cave maps. So like, why would you not do the same thing with this here. This is, okay, if people are disappearing into the earth, why is it so bizarre to say that so too is technology, so too is knowledge, and so too are potentially races that have existed for a lot longer than we realize, but had like a City of Ember things going on, where they just kind of disappeared in one day and didn't ever come out. And there might have been some spiritual reasons for that too. The surface world is trying to kill them, and so they must operate from within. Okay, this is all something that is really interesting to think about. Like when we ponder like things like Lemuria or you know, like Shambhala, Agartha, all these things, it's so quick that we go to this is like New World bullshit. But what, or New Age bullshit? But what if it's not New Age bullshit? What if out of it came New Age bullshit? Like, as these people tried to understand their plasma and their energies and all of that kind of stuff, that's exactly the type of stupidity, NPC logic that these locations feed off of. Okay, that's the way that I look at it. Because I don't really think that it's all of these weirdos and white girls coming to the mountains to stick crystals up their butt, and from it comes this god universe, this mystical, magical, high-tech spirit realm comes from that. I think it's more like you're a battery and they're harvesting from you. You are not tapping into anything. They are tapping into you because you are easily manipulated. That's kind of what I think. And then, of course, just like anything, everything will build a cult. Everything will establish a cult somehow. You can see, you know, that we'll look up at the stars and we'll make cults for specific stars. We'll look at trees. We'll make cults for specific trees. Humans love to make cults and belief sets around things. It's a really interesting and unfortunate trait of humans. But similarly, these New Agers will do that with mountains and pyramids. And if we look across time, we see this pyramid worship everywhere, coming from the old days. And I think it's because the Nephilim hid inside the mountains. I think that's your real inner earth kingdom. And of course, like, there's caves and stuff is hollow and all that kind of stuff. But when you look at stories like Mount Shasta, when you look at stories like Agartha, all that kind of stuff, it makes the most sense. So in the 1930s was when people started really being like, oh, there's something wild going on with Mount Shasta. You know, people started seeing UFOs. People started being able to witness like celebrations and stuff on the mountain, and like eerie greenish light, very ethereal visions that were coming from the mountain that people could view through their telescopes and stuff like that. And this whole thing, that like the belief set kind of set over the land, like a religion almost set over the land. And this whole thing kind of reminds me of the elves and the Huldufólk and the trolls of Iceland, and how they, over in Iceland, something like over half the population believe in these things. But it's not necessarily viewed as strange to them. It's part of their culture. And similarly, I think that is the goal of, you know, whatever lives in Mount Shasta or whatever lives in any of these inner kingdoms, and how they impact the world around them. They sort of come out and they begin to establish, and they do it very slowly over the course of centuries. They'll come out and they'll establish a sort of dominion, and then that dominion, maybe it lasts and it creates something like the New Age movement, which spawns all sorts of mini cults and all of that kind of stuff. And so mission accomplished, and you barely had to give away your hand at all because you still live in the Mount Shasta or whatever, and people don't really...
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
See you. They just see your influence. You know? I think it's something like that. And it would seem that in the 30s, Shasta was sort of opening for business, if you will. And who can say for sure if it's because they had to cover up for something that actually was seen and witnessed, or if they were trying to encourage a sort of spiritual awakening on the surface that brought more New Age style religion and rock worship and mountain worship and symbolism and star worship to the surface realm, you know? It became another mousetrap, another portal, another opening to the surface. These things aren't just everywhere. They're in very specific locations, so there might be a reason that this one opened up in the 30s. I'm not sure. You have this story by Edward Lancer. It's called The People of Mystery. But he asked the question, are they remnants of a lost race? And he's talking about the Lemurians of Mount Shasta. Do they possess a fabulous gold treasure? Coincidentally, this also came out in the 30s. And he writes, when I boarded the Shasta Limited, bound for Portland on a relatively unimportant mission, I did not dream that on this journey I was to make an astounding discovery. Sleep had deserted me at the break of dawn. My berth was stuffy. I had no reading matter at hand, so I resolved to rise, dress, and see the sunrise from the abandoned observation platform. Snow-capped Mount Shasta, the Fujiyama of America, stood before us, a fearsome, beautiful, majestic sentinel. Gazing upon its splendor, I suddenly perceived that the whole southern side of the mountain was ablaze with a strange, reddish-green light, a flame of light that grew faint, then flared up with renewed brilliance. My first conjecture was a forest fire, but the total absence of smoke discounted that theory. The light resembled the glow of Roman candles. The rising sun dimmed the color of the scene, and gradually as the train crept north, the weird phenomenon was lost to view. The thing intrigued me, yet I felt unable to discuss what I had seen with anyone. However, when I met my traveling companion at breakfast, he asked me if I had seen the forest fire on Mount Shasta. Did you see the smoke? Was my quick question. No, he replied, just a red glow. Convinced that I had not been the victim of a mirage, I later asked the conductor about the mysterious pyrotechnics, and his answer was short but enticing. Lemurians, he said. They hold ceremonies up there. Lemurians? The fact that a group of people conduct ceremonies on the side of a mountain is not of exceptional interest, but when these people are said to be Lemurians, that is startling, for the continent of Lemuria, like the lost Atlantis, disappeared beneath the ocean ages ago, and the Lemurians have long since been known as an extinct race. But just as soon as I had transacted my business in Portland, I returned to the Mount Shasta region, incredulous but consumed with curiosity. If there were survivors of that lost race, I would find them, for I planned to equip myself for an expedition into the wilderness surrounding Shasta. I motored toward the point of my investigation, pausing at Weed, a town near Mount Shasta, for the night. In Weed, I discovered that the existence of a mystic village on Mount Shasta was an accepted fact. Businessmen, amateur explorers, officials, and ranchers in the country surrounding Shasta, they all spoke freely of the Lemurian community, and all attested to the weird rituals that are performed on the mountainside at sunset, midnight, and sunrise. Also, they freely ridiculed my avowed trek into the sacred precincts, assuring me that an entrance was as difficult and forbidden as is an entrance into Tibet. It appeared that although the existence of these last descendants of the ancient Lemurians has been known to Northern Californians for more than 50 years, only 4 or 5 explorers have penetrated the invisible protective boundary of this Lemurian settlement. But no one has ever succeeded in entering the village. At least no one has ever returned to tell the tale. It is, of course, quite possible that if anybody did manage to visit the Lemurians in their Mount Shasta stronghold, such a person might have good and sufficient reasons to hold secret that which he may have seen. It is safe to say that 50 out of 100 people living within a reasonable distance of Shasta have at some time or other tried to approach the Lemurians, yet many who are known to have penetrated at least part of the mystery will vehemently deny, perhaps out of some well-founded fear, having made such an investigation or having any knowledge concerning the Lemurians. It began to look as though the whole affair was a matter of well-seasoned legendary, and yet I myself had seen the strange illumination on Mount Shasta before I had heard any of the stories that are so common in the towns surrounding the mountain. And yet it seemed incredible that a colony of people could so successfully seclude themselves in the heart of our thoroughly explored state. Just then I learned that the existence of Lemurian descendants on Mount Shasta was vouched for some years ago by no less an authority than the eminent scientist Professor Edgar Lucen Larkin, for many years director of the Mount Low Observatories, Southern California. Professor Larkin, with determined sagacity, penetrated the Shasta wilderness as far as he could, or dared, and then cleverly continued his investigation from a promontory with a powerful long-distance telescope. What the scientist saw, he reported, was a great temple in the heart of the mystic village, a marvelous work of carved marble and onyx, rivaling in beauty and architectural splendor the magnificence of the temples of Yucatan. He saw a village housing from 600 to 1,000 people. They appeared to be industriously engaged in the manufacture of articles necessary to their consumption. They were engaged in farming in the sunny slopes and glens surrounding the village, with miraculous results judging from the astounding vegetation revealed to Professor Larkin's spyglass. He found them to be a peaceful community, evidently contented to live as their ancient forebears had lived before Lemuria was swallowed up by the sea. When Professor Larkin concluded his investigation, he had gathered enough proof to warrant him to say that in this village, in a secluded glen at the foot of Mount Shasta, partially extinct volcano, far from the beaten paths that led to our civilization, there lived the last descendants of the first inhabitants of this earth, the Lemurians. Some scientists have long ago declared that certain of these early people migrated to other parts of the Earth before the continents of Atlantis and Lemuria are supposed to have disappeared beneath the waters of the ocean, and the Lemurians on Shasta are doubtless the descendants of those early survivors who trekked to the American continent, possibly South America, the succeeding generations finally moving north to California. That these Lemurians who live in California are cognizant of that disaster that befell their ancestors is revealed in the fact that each night at midnight throughout the entire year, they perform a ritual of thanksgiving and adoration to Gautama, which is the Lemurian name for America. The chief object of this midnight ceremony is to celebrate the escape of their forebears from the doomed Lemuria and their safe arrival in Gautama. The article goes on, apparently these Lemurians are clothed in white robes, and he says that various merchants in the vicinity of Shasta report that these white-robed men occasionally come to their stores. Their purchases are of a peculiar nature. They have brought enormous quantities of sulfur, as well as a great deal of salt. They buy lard in bulk quantities for which they bring their own containers, peculiar transparent bladders. The gay materials and novelties of our modern civilization do not attract these simple people at all. Their purchases are always paid for with gold nuggets, since, of course, they have no money, and the gold always far exceeds the value of their merchandise. Perhaps this gold is another reason why we are not made welcome in Lemurian territory. They have frequently donated their large gold nuggets to charity. During the World War, they came forward with generous gifts to the American Red Cross, and more recently, they sent a bag of gold to the fund for sufferers of the Japanese earthquake. And the article goes on and on. They have the power of invisibility, which is how they have been hidden all of this time. People say the story is incredible. Other people say they have seen the ceremonies as well. So what we got going on here, to sum all this up, I'm not trying to convince you that Lemuria was real or that it's, you know, the remnants of these people are inside Mount Shasta even. It's just the location I'm picking on today. But Rather, what I'm trying to say is, I think that the inner earth is just literally a Nephilim kingdom. And that when we have these stories from high profile individuals and scientists and doctors and Navy admirals and, you know, all of these explorers and all of these people who, you know, like, go hunting for these things, and they have stories and reasons for why they believe in them. It's because they probably are seeing something that has existed throughout time. It's probably not because they all want to get in on some joke. And if there is actually a civilization that has existed from the dawn of time, essentially, that has managed to continue inside the Earth, I assume that these are spiritual entities that would have expanded upon their abilities over the course of thousands of years. And if they have an unadulterated sort of science, set of sciences and arts to pull from, because they stole them from early man, then you would have what appears to be a high-tech, highly advanced, majestic kingdom inside the Earth. That's what you would have. And we see examples of these things in the megaliths and certain other feats that humanity had, you know, the things like the pyramids and stuff like that. Things like the Library of Alexandria, things that we can't really explain. We have examples of these feats that these Nephilim overlords, these who are now of the inner realm, have sort of assisted humanity with on the surface. So it's no real gigantic conspiracy then to see them as continuing to live on inside the Earth in the same way, in a way that looks majestic and holy and wondrous to us. They're the oldest civilization on the planet, perhaps. Of course they would advance. Of course they would continue to be majestic to us humans who have never witnessed something like this. There you go. Thank you for watching, everybody. The life is in the blood.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.